I'm Deborah Becker, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. This fall, six teenagers from South Hadley, Massachusetts, will be in court to face a series of charges stemming from the death of Phoebe Prince. Prince was 15 years old when she hanged herself in January. In the days after her suicide, a shocking story started to take shape. It was that Prince, who had moved to town from Ireland at the start of the school year, had been relentlessly bullied by her classmates. The new girl in town, the story went, was popular with boys, and that a pack of kids, now called the South Hadley Six, targeted her. After a particularly difficult day at school, Phoebe Prince went home and killed herself. The story became national and international news. Parents were shocked that Prince's tormentors were allowed to stay in school after the suicide. And then the district attorney got involved. And soon, several students were charged with violating Prince's civil rights. Two boys were charged with statutory rape. So who is responsible for Phoebe Prince's death? Are the students to blame? Emily Bazelon is senior editor at the online magazine Slate.com. The title of her latest story is What Really Happened to Phoebe Prince, and she joins us from NPR studios in New York. And Emily, you interviewed students and staff at the school, and you paint a complex picture of Phoebe Prince. Talk about the person she was when she first arrived at South Hadley High School.
Well, this is still a really sad story, and it is, of course, tragic that Phoebe Prince killed herself and she should not have been bullied. But it's also, as you said, a more complicated story than it first appeared. Before Phoebe ever got to South Hadley, back in 2008, she started having trouble with other girls at the Irish school she was going to. And her mother says that it was fights over boys. And Phoebe started cutting herself and then in 2009 went on antidepressants. So, you know, before she arrived in the United States, she had this troubled mental health history that has until now not really been publicized.
And her father stayed behind in Ireland because her parents were separating.
That's right. And so that's an additional factor that she was dealing with this fall. And it's clear from an essay she wrote in English class that she really missed her father.
Did school authorities know about the separation and about her history of mental illness?
They did. Phoebe's mother says that when she enrolled Phoebe in the school, she told a counselor that Phoebe had this history of being bullied and this history of being on antidepressants. And that counselor told the principal that information, but it wasn't necessarily, I'm not sure of this, but it seems as if it wasn't spread more widely through the school, in part probably because of privacy concerns.
But what about action taken as well? Do you know about what action may have been taken because of what school officials knew?
In November, Phoebe had a previous suicide attempt. That was a serious attempt. She was hospitalized for a week. And by that point, a counselor at the school and also the school nurse were in regular contact with Phoebe and her mother. The question, I think, is whether there should have been some kind of broader effort by the school to, you know, really monitor her. And I'm just honestly not sure. You know, in hindsight, it seems like, yes, they should have done that. But as it was actually unfolding, I'm not sure whether it's how much is really reasonable to expect of a big high school in this circumstance.
Mm-hmm. And the suicide attempt in November, do we know what prompted that?
It seems like the immediate cause of it was a breakup with a boy, Sean Mulvihill, who's one of the kids who's been charged in connection with Phoebe's death. And then, of course, there's this question of how much these underlying struggles she was having played into the suicide attempt as well.
Did these other students target Phoebe as extensively as has been reported?
You know, not as extensively. One of the confusions in this case is about how long this bullying really took place for and whether it was sort of a pack of kids in a coordinated campaign. And neither of those things really are as they have been reported. The bullying really was intense on the day that Phoebe died, and it involved three kids, not six kids. The other three kids who have been charged in this case are not accused of going anywhere near Phoebe in the week before she died. And that's not to say there were, you know, absolutely no incidents before that day. Phoebe was having conflicts with other kids. But the conduct that I think, you know, really jumps out as being egregious is from that last day.
Are you concerned that when you say something like that, you know, what you consider egregious, that you're almost saying, you know, some of this is teenage behavior?
Yeah, I think it is hard because I actually, my main impression from talking to many of the kids at South Hadley High was that they saw what was happening with Phoebe as kind of normal girl drama, as a couple of them put it to me. She was having fights over boys, and that was something that happened in this school, and kids would, you know, kind of flip out on each other, as they say. So I don't mean to suggest that that's good, certainly, or that the bullying that Phoebe endured, particularly on that last day, is okay. It really wasn't. But I do think there's a question here of proportional punishment. The kids who have been charged in this case have all been thrown out of school. Their lives have been, you know, completely upended. They've become these kind of paradigms of teenage evil in the eyes of the media and on the web. And the question is whether, you know, that's just really enough.
Right, because in your story, you also write about another bullying case in South Hadley from May of 2009. You want to explain that?
Yeah, this is an entirely separate case in which a gay student at South Hadley High was in line throwing away his trash in the lunchroom one day, and another boy came up behind him and put his hand down the pants of this gay student. And the gay student immediately reported what had happened. And he says that he was completely satisfied by the school's response. They suspended the offending student for the duration of the school year. He was not allowed to walk at graduation. But the district attorney also brought charges in this case. And when I went to a pretrial proceeding this past May, the district attorney who was there asked for a guilty finding for the offending student, that if he was indeed found guilty, he would go onto the sex offender registry in Massachusetts for 20 years. And again, I think this just raises a question about proportional punishment.
So are you saying you think the DA in Western Massachusetts is too aggressive?
In these cases, yes, I would say those are the questions I would want the community to ask, exactly.
In the case of Phoebe Prince, though, by bringing up her history in Ireland, a history of mental illness, the fact that she was on antidepressants and that this had happened before, in a way, it must be difficult to write because you have to question whether you're almost blaming the victim to a certain extent.
Yes, that is a real struggle. And I really, truly do not intend that to be the message of the story at all. It's absolutely not Phoebe Prince's fault that she was having these problems. And I think in ordinary circumstances, these are the kinds of details about a young girl's death that we would leave private. The problem is that there are six other kids whose futures are on the line. And in order to explain the real context for the trouble Phoebe was having in school with other kids and the conflict she was involved with, I think it's important to know about her mental health history. And the other thing that matters to me is that most of the kids who were charged really had no idea that Phoebe was dealing with all these issues. And I'm just not sure that it's fair to put on them that they should have anticipated what the consequences of their actions would be.
But certainly their actions, in some cases, their actions were horrendous.
Right. On the day that Phoebe died, there's no question that three of the kids really tormented her in a way that I think nobody, you know, would countenance. They were yelling at her in the hallway and in the library. They were certainly calling her names in a really cruel way. Absolutely.
And then shouldn't they be held responsible?
They should be held responsible, but I think you can be held responsible by being, you know, disciplined in school. I think that facing criminal charges that carry a maximum penalty of 10 years in prison is extreme. We do not usually threaten kids with prison for being nasty to each other.
Let's talk about some of the specific charges against the kids involved here. If we're trying to question whether the punishment is proportional, some of them are charged with civil rights violations. Isn't that right? Can you explain the charges? And then the two boys, as we said, are charged with statutory rape.
Right. So the most serious charge that five of the kids are facing is called civil rights violation with bodily injury. The civil rights part is a very broadly written statute that essentially says, you know, any attempt to threaten or harass or oppress is illegal. And then the bodily injury, at least as the defense lawyers expect it to be argued, is Phoebe's death. And so that really means that the district attorney is blaming these kids for Phoebe's suicide. And that's very unusual. It's very unusual to see other people charged in relation to someone's killing themselves.
And civil rights because they mentioned her heritage, really.
Right. They called her an Irish slut as opposed to not saying that. And then there's also this question of whether they interfered with her right to an education. That's another part of the district attorney's theory in the case.
Mm-hmm. And the statutory rape charges against the two boys is also something that's unusual in a case like this.
That's right. One of these boys was 18 and one was 17, and Phoebe Prince was 15. And in Massachusetts, the age of consent is 16. Now, we very rarely see boys of this age charged for having sex with a 15-year-old girl. That's a really unusual step to take. And there's also a question, particularly in one of these cases, about whether, in fact, the kids had sex.
You know, your story also outlines a lot of what was happening online at the time, a lot of Facebook comments, the things that were written on the memorial page online that was dedicated to Phoebe Prince after her suicide. Can you explain a little bit about what was happening online and then sort of what the fallout has been of how adults might be able to help? Have we really answered that question?
I think this is a real struggle for parents. You know, what the online bullying does is that it intensifies the behavior that's already happening in person, and it makes it feel kind of incessant and inescapable to the person who's being targeted. This isn't to say that in Phoebe's case there was a huge amount of online bullying, because I haven't really seen evidence of that. But still, you can imagine that, you know, for other kids who really do face this, it's impossible not to look on Facebook and see what other kids are saying about you. And then for parents, I think the real challenge is how to monitor this, because, you know, the internet, kids' use of the internet is still really a kind of wild west, and it's very hard for parents to control what their kids are doing every day online.
Now, Massachusetts, in response to Phoebe Prince's suicide and the suicide of another young boy out in western Massachusetts a year earlier, did implement a new anti-bullying law that's supposed to address some of the concerns. Do you think that that will become a model for other states? Do you think that would help in a case like this?
I think it certainly could. One of the provisions of the new law is that it mandates reporting of bullying. And so that really should put teachers and other staff at the school on alert that if they see one kid taunting, you know, in a vicious way another kid, they need to report it. The other thing the law does is tell all the schools that they need to start doing trainings with teachers and have some curricula for students about bullying. And so if they can find some programs that are effective in reducing bullying, that could have a really positive impact.
A lot of the information that you talk about in your story is private information. You say that staff members wouldn't necessarily give their names when they spoke with you because they wanted to be anonymous. There's also the Prince family. Phoebe Prince's family has not spoken. A lot of lawyers didn't call you back. In terms of where you were able to get your information from to be able to paint this picture of this story, where did the information come from? Are you confident enough that this is really the accurate picture that that was going on at the school at the time?
I am confident about that, in part from the many interviews I've done in the town with both students and adults in the community, and also because of some of the police interviews that I was able to see.
Emily Bazelon is a senior editor at the online magazine Slate.com. The title of her story is What Really Happened to Phoebe Prince. Emily, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Thanks for having me.
And two notes now. First, a correction. Yesterday in our show, we said that the federal extension of unemployment benefits applies to people who have been out of work for 99 weeks or more. That is not correct. The legislation actually extends benefits through November for people who've exhausted their state's 26 weeks of jobless benefits, but who have not yet used up all of the allowable 99 weeks of emergency federal benefits. And we had intended to talk today about France's proposed ban on facial coverings for Muslim women. We'll have that conversation tomorrow. Back in a minute, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from The MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back. Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack now says he's willing to consider rehiring the woman at the center of a racially charged controversy. Shirley Sherrod said that the administration forced her to resign from her job yesterday as the director of a rural development program in Georgia after a conservative blogger posted a video clip of her speaking at a local NAACP banquet in March. In the clip, she said that she did not do everything she could have to help a white farmer because of her own bias. But that wasn't the whole story. That clip was taken out of context. When you look at the entire video, Sherrod actually went on to describe how she overcame her prejudices and actually ended up helping that white family save their farm 20 years ago. To see the entire video, go to our website, hereandnow.org. But right now, we want to talk about this with Jay Newton Small. She's Washington correspondent for Time magazine. Thanks for being with us, Jay.
Thanks for having me on, Deb.
This story really blew up quickly. Can you just take us through briefly what happened?
Sure. Essentially, conservatives have been, and this goes back a little farther than just having to do with Sherrod, conservatives have been arguing back and forth with the NAACP about whether or not the Tea Party movement is racist. And so they've been digging up old clips of what they say at the end of that prove that the NAACP itself is racist. And this is one of the clips that they dug up. Now, it was heavily edited and only included one section in which she seemed to say that she wouldn't provide the same amount of service or hadn't provided the same amount of service to this white farmer that seemed entitled. Now, this was nearly 20 years ago, and in fact, she wasn't actually working for the government at the time. Listening to what had happened, you know, this sort of one quote taken out of context, the administration kind of overreacted. Vilsack, without even talking to her, without even asking for an explanation, Tom Vilsack, who's the Secretary of Agriculture, immediately fired her. The NAACP condemned her. And then, the rest of the video started to surface. And so you had this very interesting timeline where you have the rest of the video starting to come to light. The NAACP is literally listening to it on a phone line, trying to figure out what's going on. And then they backtracked. They called the White House and they called the Agriculture Department and said, "We think we've been snookered. You've been snookered. She needs another shot at getting her job back." And so throughout yesterday evening and into this morning, everybody's been very quickly backpedaling and saying, actually, maybe we've taken this out of context, because, in fact, the entire video talks a lot about her overcoming her hatred. And, in fact, reporters have found this farmer, and he said, his wife had said, she helped us save the farm. So the full context of the video really does show that perhaps a very knee-jerk reaction by the administration and by the NAACP in rushing to condemn this woman for something that she actually didn't do.
You know, it seems very surprising that would have happened without someone trying to get to the bottom of what actually happened.
Or at least even ask her, which is very surprising. Like, why did you say this? You know, what's the context in saying it? And so, I mean, you've seen her this morning. She's been on half of the morning shows on TV, and she's been really everywhere. And she's, you know, Tom Vilsack is now saying perhaps she'll get her job back. And she's saying, well, I don't know if I want my job back anymore, you know. But I think it also speaks to a sensitivity that the White House has about seeming to show favor to African Americans or blacks and not wanting to sort of play favorites with anybody or be perceived as playing favorites. And I think that kind of knee-jerk reaction goes to that.
Those of us, especially those of us in Boston, might remember the criticism of President Obama last year when the Cambridge police arrested Harvard scholar Henry Louis Gates. And when President Obama was asked for his reaction initially, he said that what he thought the police did was stupid. And then, of course, he held the beer summit at the White House, and things seemed to calm down somewhat. But do you think that may have played into the fact that the White House is sensitive?
Yeah, I think partly that is that, you know, that they immediately get leapt on for seeming like they're playing favorites. Anything that he does, he's sort of damned if you do, damned if he doesn't kind of thing. Because, in fact, when you talk to the black community and you talk to at least the Congressional Black Caucus and even people at the NAACP, they feel that he's actually gone out of his way to sort of not favor them, and to the point where they feel a little bit neglected under this president, that they haven't received the kind of change that they could believe in when they've all voted for him to become the first black president, and they really wanted to see a little bit more from this administration, and they haven't seen that, and they've actually been quite vocal in their disappointment with the administration.
What do they want?
Well, I think that they feel that, you know, a lot of, for example, a lot of the stimulus funds that they could have been directed more to, say, poor black neighborhoods. There hasn't been enough sort of specific targeting of blacks in need, of poor blacks, black areas, that they felt that they would get more help, frankly, under this president and from this Congress. They, in fact, even tried to block a few votes last fall in the House because they felt that not enough of the stimulus funds had gone to needy black areas. So, and that's just sort of one part of their complaint. The Congressional Black Caucus also feels that, you know, he's never come to visit them. He's never come to talk to them. He doesn't highlight black causes enough. They just feel that he could be doing a lot more to sort of address specific African-American issues.
You know, you mentioned the Tea Party at the start of our conversation. MSNBC has been criticizing the Tea Party, saying that there are some racist elements within the Tea Party. Vice President Biden has said the Tea Party is not racist as a whole. Do you think that there would be some significant political fallout here if the president tried to get involved in that debate?
most likely the president would probably take the same position that Vice President Biden has taken. I mean, you can't categorize an entire group of people by a few incidents that have happened. And it is a big argument. And there have been incidents, you know, for example, during the whole health care debate, there was a big Tea Party, and I was there for this. There was a big Tea Party protest out in front of Capitol Hill. And some of the, you know, like Joe Lewis and some of these lionized members of Congress who were at the forefront of the civil rights movement were walking through the crowd and people were yelling at them. They were calling them, you know, expletive, the N-word, you know, really horrible things. And the crowd was really quite ugly. I mean, I'm a Eurasian descent, and you know, someone said, go home to China, you know, and I was sort of like, really? That's, I don't know. It got pretty ugly at that one particular rally. But I don't think that you could, obviously, I mean, I've covered tons of Tea Party rallies. I've never had a problem before. And just because one person yells something at you or one person yells, you know, at these members doesn't mean that the entire movement is obviously tainted. There are millions of people who define themselves as Tea Partiers in the United States.
J. Newton Small of Time Magazine talking with us about how the issue of race is affecting the political debate. We'll all be waiting to see what happens. Thanks, Jay.
Thank you.
Tomorrow on Here and Now, we look at the Wyoming governor's threat to sell a piece of Grand Teton National Park unless the federal government agrees to a land swap. That's tomorrow. News is next. Here and Now. I'm Deborah Becker, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Some say it's the greatest test of human endurance. Some say it's madness. Racing a bicycle 2,200 miles over 3 weeks through mountains and valleys in blistering summer heat. I'd go with madness. But it's the Tour de France. Today's the second and final rest day for the riders, and there are just 4 days of racing left. Seven-time champion Lance Armstrong will not win, but who will? Well, joining us from Po, France is David LaRue. He's senior online editor for Bicycling Magazine. And David, let's begin with Lance Armstrong. Sum up his performance so far.
You know, Lance Armstrong has not had his best Tour de France this year, and things kind of started out on the wrong foot in stage four. He was trying to maintain some time over a cobbled section. He punctured his tire and ended up losing time on that stage. Things settled down there for the next few stages. Well, on stage eight, he was bitten by the bad luck bug again, and he crashed pretty hard right before the big climb into the Alps on stage eight. He clipped a pedal on a roundabout, crashed going over 50 kilometers an hour, and his team had to race really hard just to get him back up with the leaders. He popped, which in cycling terms means you just lost everything. You've spent everything in the tank and you can't do it anymore. And he ended up rolling in some 12 minutes behind the overall leaders. And for all intents and purposes, his Tour de France overall title hopes were shot at that point.
Now, he says after this race he's retiring from professional cycling. And, you know, he has retired before, but he is, you know, the ripe old age of 38. Do you think that we should believe him?
Yeah, I think so, actually. And a pretty telling quote after stage 16, where he did take a flyer and tried to win one last stage at the Tour de France and was nipped at the end by Frenchman Pierre Federigo. Lance said at the end, when asked if this was it for him or if he had any hopes now that he could still hang with a front group, he said, Lance Armstrong is over in about 4 or 5 days. So there's some talk of him competing in triathlons, which is something that he did when he was younger before he became a committed full-time professional cyclist. But as far as it goes for competing for the overall title in the Tour de France and in professional cycling, I think this is it here when they hit Paris on Sunday.
What might happen to the race when he does leave?
You know, the thing about cycling right now is the sport is in great shape with young stars like Alberto Contador and Andy Schleck, who are the two contenders that are leading the overall race right now. In many opinions, Alberto Contador may be one of the best racers to ever race the Tour de France. So, you know, I think the state of the sport is as good as it's ever been, certainly for the Tour de France and back home in the United States.
Well, let's talk about Contador and Schleck, who seem to be in the lead here. And there's a little controversy going on between them. Can you explain?
Well, what happened with Alberto Contador and Andy Schleck was on stage 14, which was one of the first stages as they came back into the mountains in the south of France and the Pyrenees, the two were neck and neck for the overall title, as they still are. Andy Schleck attacked on one of the first climbs, and he started to get a gap on Contador, and Contador followed, and at that very instant, Andy Schleck had a mechanical problem. The chain came off of his front chain ring. and he had to stop pedaling and get off his bike to fix it. Well, at that time, Contador continued on up the road along with other overall title rivals, Denny Menchoff and Samuel Sanchez. The real crux of the controversy there is that there's sort of an unwritten rule at the Tour de France that you don't attack the yellow jersey when the yellow jersey is having some sort of problem or is in duress, as Schleck was at this point. But what happened was they ended up gaining a bunch of time on Schleck that day, and Contador took over the yellow jersey and is now in the overall lead by a mere 8 seconds.
And Schleck initially said he was out for revenge, but then he said that Contador apologized and now they're good. Do you think that's what we'll see when they go back to racing?
Well, I think when they go back to racing, which is tomorrow, Thursday, stage 17, as they climb the legendary Tourmalet climb, it's a mountaintop finish, I think the gloves will be completely off. This is Andy Schleck's last chance to really gain some time on Contador going into the final days of the race, and tomorrow should be a really exciting stage with the mountaintop finish. That's the time when the real climbers like Contador and Schleck have the opportunity to put major time on their rivals. And we're thinking that's what we'll see tomorrow for sure.
All right, David LaRue, senior online editor for Bicycling Magazine. Thanks for speaking with us.
Absolutely. Thank you.
We'll be back in 30 seconds with a look at the other wells in the Gulf of Mexico. It's Here and Now. The U.S. Coast Guard chief in charge of cleaning up BP's Gulf of Mexico oil disaster expects a relief tunnel will reach the blown-up well this weekend, so it may soon be plugged for good. What that means is that BP's Macondo well below the Deepwater Horizon rig will join more than 27,000 abandoned wells in the Gulf of Mexico. A recent investigation by the Associated Press counted the wells in the Gulf and found some 50,000 of them. It also discovered a government warning that some of these wells have the potential to cause an environmental disaster. Joining us is AP national writer Jeff Don. He co-authored the investigation for the AP. Welcome, Jeff.
Thanks very much. Nice to be here.
That environmental disaster warning that we talked about, that was issued in 1994. Can you explain?
Yes. The Government Accountability Office looked at the potential for leaks in these offshore wells. The companies abandon them when they're done producing or they're done exploring with them. And the GAO found that they have the potential to leak, and that leakage can be serious enough to really do damage to the aquatic species. And it warned of an environmental disaster and called for the government to create an inspection program to inspect the work when these abandoned wells are initially abandoned and sealed. Mm. And that never happened.
So we do right now have no process for inspecting and checking those wells that are abandoned.
The government regulators can and do occasionally inspect the work as it's done, the sealing work, if, as they put it, they have reason to expect something unusual. They do not routinely inspect the sealing work. They do not go back and monitor for leaks. The industry doesn't go back and monitor for leaks. And yet, the EPA said some years ago that on land, well plugging, the abandonment work, is generally poorly designed, poorly executed, and there's no reason to believe that things are very different offshore, unfortunately, either.
Now, you found some 27,000 abandoned wells in the Gulf alone, and there's a difference between permanently and temporarily abandoned. Is that right?
That's correct. The idea of temporary abandonment is that a company might want to go back to a well. Maybe it's waiting for the price of oil to rise. Maybe there was a storm and it temporarily abandoned the well and wants to go back to it. Maybe it's reassessing the value of the well. And the sealing work is similar for temporary abandonment, but not as extensive. The testing isn't as extensive. If you're going to abandon a well permanently, you're supposed to cut off that casing, the piping around the well. You're supposed to cut it off 15 feet below the seafloor. If you temporarily abandon it, you leave it and you just put a corrosion cap on it to try to limit the corrosion from the ocean water.
Now, I read that the Deepwater Horizon well, BP's Deepwater Horizon well, was in the process of being temporarily abandoned at the time that it ruptured in April. Is that correct?
That's correct. We found the paperwork that showed that BP was temporarily abandoning that well, and that's the cement plug that you hear a lot of talk about, that you've read a lot about. They were plugging the well to abandon it temporarily just before the blowout happened. I mean, this is evidence, if you need evidence, that the kind of plugs they use when they abandon a well can not work correctly.
Of the 27,000 abandoned wells, how many are temporary, how many are permanent?
About 3,500 are temporarily abandoned. About 23,500 are permanently abandoned. Of the 3,500 temporarily abandoned wells, some have been temporarily abandoned. And if I could put quotes around temporarily on radio, I would. Some have been temporarily abandoned since the 1950s and 1960s. So even though the regulations call for an annual review and they call for the operator to come back every year and say, we're going to reuse this well, or here's our plan to permanently abandon it and have the full safeguards, even though the regulations say that, clearly at least the spirit of the regulations are being circumvented for decades.
Because it's very expensive for these companies to do this.
It is. It's more expensive, obviously, to permanently abandon and to cut off the casing that I was talking about before. It is very expensive to do, and our analysis showed that just on the wells that exist now and will need to be sealed, it would cost something like $3 billion. That's billion with a B. Now, your common sense tells you that even though the companies have some liability, that can't be a profit center for the companies.
If we go back to BP's Deepwater Horizon, well, what we're hearing right now is that there's some seepage around there that the Coast Guard has said may be from an old well.
The Associated Press has actually mapped nearby wells and found two of them within 2 miles. Other wells are farther away, no closer than 8 miles. And those two wells, of those two wells, one is a temporarily abandoned well, and another is another exploratory well that was completed, was probably used for production for a time. It's not clear which of those wells he's talking about, but he did say in his remarks yesterday that old wells often leak. And that was the kind of utterance you just wouldn't have heard from government officials probably even a month ago.
Do you think we're going to see some action legislatively or anywhere, really, to try to make sure that there are more stringent regulations on these old abandoned wells?
Well, I can tell you a couple things about that. One is that environmental groups have called for that kind of thing. Another is that Mark Udall, the Colorado senator, sent a letter to his fellow Coloradan, Ken Salazar, the Interior Secretary, and he asked Salazar, what kind of tools, additional tools, might you need to do a better job of regulating these abandoned wells? And I can also tell you that the House Energy Committee has broadened its investigation to include abandoned wells, and they've asked a whole shopping list of questions to Salazar about how many there are, how well they're inspected, how well they're monitored after they're plugged, this whole range of questions now that the House Energy Committee wants to know.
Were you surprised by what you found in this investigation?
Virtually everyone I talked to before the story was released said 50,000 wells in the Gulf of Mexico. I had no idea. And then when I told them more than half had been abandoned, they were flabbergasted. And that number was one of the most interesting and surprising things about the story and about the investigation. And that number is also one of the most telling things, because even if a small percentage of them leak, that could be a big problem. And that's what the EPA said when it looked at the question of abandoned wells on land some years ago. It said up to 17% could be improperly plugged. If that applies to the Gulf of Mexico, that would be thousands of wells in the Gulf that are not correctly sealed.
AP national writer Jeff Dunn, who co-authored the investigation, finding some 27,000 wells abandoned in the Gulf of Mexico and lacks government inspection of them. Thanks very much for speaking
with us. You're very welcome.
And before we go today, the benefits of slow reading. You're listening to Here and Now.
Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org.
Welcome back. You've probably heard of the slow food movement. Well, there's a slow reading movement, too. It encourages people to savor the written word, not on a screen, but on a page, and often to read out loud. There isn't much formal research done on whether it helps students do well in school or later in life, but proponents say slow reading makes a world of difference. Professor Thomas Newkirk teaches writing at the University of New Hampshire and at the annual Summer Writers Academy for middle and high school students there. He joins us from the UNH studio in Durham. Welcome, Professor.
Happy to be here, Deb.
Also with you, we have Helene Kenny. She's a 12-year-old student at the Cooperative Middle School in Stratham, New Hampshire, and this is her second time attending the Writers Academy, and Evan Howard, a 15-year-old student at the Oyster River High School in Durham, New Hampshire. He is back for his second summer at the Writers Academy as well, so we'll be speaking with them in just a minute. But let's start with you, Professor. How do you define slow reading, and what is it?
I think the key is paying attention. I think we're in a culture of distraction where on the websites we move from page to page. Slow reading, as I see it, is paying attention. It's establishing a relationship with a writer. It's persevering. It's hearing the voice of that writer. And I think in doing so, it's really gaining the most pleasure we can get from our reading.
Aren't there times, though, when we can't possibly read everything slowly? There's either law students who have volumes and volumes of things that they need to read and be able to summarize quickly, or some things just aren't that significant. We just need to know them instantaneously, and it's okay if we forget them.
Absolutely. I think that I'm not saying this is something we should read everything slowly, but I think we're in a culture where it's been said that even instant gratification is too slow.
So what do you do in your classroom to try to encourage students to read more slowly?
Well, one thing, I think you need to read beginnings of things slowly. I think authors work so hard to write beginnings, and I think to take that slowly, to try to figure out who is this person writing, what is this book going to be about. And I think a lot of reading out loud, I do a lot of reading out loud, and so you hear the voice of an author. Authors talk a lot about voice and how hard it is to get the right voice, and I think as readers we have to hear that voice. And so I think reading aloud helps students hear the voice of the author. And then I think after a while they can create that voice in their own head.
Do you run the risk of maybe sort of almost romanticizing? Oh, if we go back to a time when, we were all reading by candlelight and life was a lot slower. Do you think that you're almost saying that this was definitely a better thing in a better time, and maybe for some reason, evolutionary-wise or biologically-wise, we needed to speed it up a little because we needed to be able to keep up with demands of modern life?
Well, I think we do need to speed up to keep up with some of the demands of modern life, but it's interesting. I talk to faculty members. We read for a living, and it's amazing how many of them come to me and say, I'm a slow reader. And it's like there's this whole collection of people who read for their profession who are slow readers. So I really want to ask them questions and learn about how they read, because I think that this is a phenomenon that's not fully discussed.
When they're saying slow readers, it means that they like to read slowly? Is that what they're saying?
I think they get pleasure from reading slowly. I think when you read slowly, you pay attention to sound. I think you have a greater sensuous experience in reading. I think you remember better. I think that, you stop to pay attention to, summarize and think about what you've read. I really think thinking itself is an act of slowing down, because if you're moving at a really fast pace, you're just reinforcing what you already believe. But I think when you slow down, you have a chance to really, really rethink who you are and what you believe.
Hmm. Well, let's bring in Helene and Evan and talk with them a little bit about slow reading. They're both writing. They're attending the Writing Academy at the University of New Hampshire. And I'd like to ask Helene, do you like to pick up a book when you read? Do you mind reading on the screen, or is there a difference for you?
I like picking up a book a lot better, because looking at a screen just makes me a little bit sleepy. And I don't know, picking up a book, it has a better feel to it, I guess.
What does slow reading mean to you?
Well, I think in this world, everything's really rushed, and if you read slowly, you get a better picture in your head. You get to feel like you're really there with what you're reading.
Now, are you online at all in terms of Facebook or any of those things yet?
I'm not on Facebook.
But do you have a cell phone and you can text?
Nope, I don't have a cell phone. So I don't want to have a cell phone either.
You don't?
No, I don't.
Do you find that unusual among your friends?
Yes, I do.
And why don't you want one?
Well, I like talking better than texting. Texting just seems like I'm wasting my voice. Without my voice, I just feel isolated, so.
Well, that's interesting. I understand you brought some of your writing with you.
Yes, I did.
Would you like to describe it a little bit for us and read some of it?
Sure. Well, I did a small piece. We were supposed to take a certain feeling and personify it, and I did mine on uncertainty. Uncertainty. To be uncertain. The large cloaked figure that stands there, watching your every move. He doesn't speak, doesn't stir, just watches and listens and waits. Waits for the right moment to pounce. When you reach a fork in the road, he tackles you and pins you to the ground. A shivering cold seems to wash over you as you stare into those black, merciless eyes. It is in this moment that uncertainty seems to stare within. Then, very slowly, it lets go of you, and with a swish of its cloak, disappears into the mist. You jump up as if nothing has happened, but are left with a feeling of uncertainty of which path to choose.
Very nice.
Thank you.
What advice do you have for readers or writers, Helene?
Well, just pay attention to what you're reading, because if you scan, you don't absorb anything and it doesn't sink in if you're reading a book with depth. So you need to slow down and listen to the words as though someone was actually speaking it, so that you really feel what's going on.
Mm-hmm. And Evan, how about you? Are you a writer?
I am. Pretty avid writer.
Yeah? And have you been a writer for a long time?
Yeah, since around the fifth or sixth grade, I've been really interested in writing.
Mm-hmm. I understand that you have a favorite writer.
I do.
Who's that?
Langston Hughes.
And you brought along a poem Langston Hughes wrote?
I did. This is from the poem called The Minstrel Man. Because my mouth is wide with laughter, and my throat is deep in song, you do not know I suffer after I've held pain so long. Because my mouth is wide with laughter, you do not hear my inner cry. Because my feet are gay with dancing, you do not know I die.
Very nice. What's your advice for readers or writers? Do you have any?
I would say for readers to slow down and appreciate what you're reading, because it could definitely, you know, help you find your voice, and it just opens up a whole new perspective on everything for me.
Very nice. And Professor, I'd like to ask you, do you think that the slow reading has influenced this? Or we're talking about kids who are interested in writing and, mm-hmm. and they want to be writers and they'll likely probably have a future that includes something to do with writing. Is slow reading for the writerly types, or is it for everybody?
Well, I'd like to think it's for everybody. I think that some kids early on, because they're slow readers, assume they're poor readers. And so they stop reading. And I think if we keep sending them the message that it's fine to be a slow reader as long as you're getting the meaning of what you're reading, they'll stay with reading.
Well, we've got some very impressive students with you.
Thank you.
Professor Thomas Newkirk teaches writing at the University of New Hampshire and at its annual Summer Writers Academy for Teenagers. Helene Kenny is a student at the Cooperative Middle School in Stratham, New Hampshire. Evan Howard is a student at the Oyster River High School in Durham, New Hampshire. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI. I'm Deborah Becker. Please join us again. Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from The MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.